Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
So, once again, it is Spoiler Filled Film Conversation Hooray time. I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. And with me is Anthony Evans.
Hello.
Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
And Abigail Bain.
Hello.
I nearly said your name wrong, Jamie, because there's a Welsh newsreader who I caught talking the other day, and he passed to his, I don't know, weatherman or sports guy, and he went, Thomas, as if, oh, I have to say it as a Welsh person, Thomas.
Thomas.
Thomas. I don't know, you don't pronounce your surname Thomas, do you?
I will now.
Jamie Thomas.
Thomas.
Anyway. So, you know, the podcast is about chatting about a film. You know, we sort of bat it about between us and figure out whether we liked it or hated it or what we thought of some of the minutiae of the film. You know, it's a film podcast, yeah? Yeah? That's for you, listener. Just clarifying. We are going to be four not very angry people discussing the film 12 Angry Men. Although, you know, if we have some disagreements, we might get quite heated about it.
That's why I'm a very angry person.
Oh,
although
well,
not a man, so...
We are going to be one angry woman and three calm men discussing the film 12 Angry Men, and it was Jamie's pick, so he can tell you, you know, which 12 Angry Men we're going to discuss.
Okay. 12 Angry Men is from 1957, directed by Sidney Lumet, and written by Reginald Rose. A dissenting juror in a murder trial slowly manages to convince the others that the case is not as obviously clear as it seemed in court. It's hard to list the cast because it's full of, like, I don't know. It's a horrible cliche, but it's a stellar cast. I guess if there are any leads in it, it would be Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb. But everyone kind of has a pretty decent spotlight on them at some point or another. It also stars Jack Klugman, who I didn't realise was Quincy. Dr. Quincy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't recognise him without the wheelchair.
Was it? What?
What?
Quincy not in a wheelchair.
That's Ironside.
No.
Oh, yeah.
And also, Ironside was never a doctor.
Yeah, what am I thinking of? What's Ironside. The medicine woman? What's her name? Was she in it?
Dr. Quinn.
Okay,
yeah, no.
It's not Dr. Quinn either.
Was it Quincy MD or what was his name?
I'm genuinely lost. Dick Van
anyway,
Dyke, he was a doctor.
Yes, you're right. Diagnosis, Jack Klugman, who played Dick Van Dyke in Diagnosis Murder, did also, I want to put this out there, because it's almost a personal tradition of mine. Did anyone pick up on the Exorcist connection?
I did not. There was one.
No.
Well, there always is one.
There's
several.
With Jamie's picks, there always is, yeah.
Yeah. Lee J. Cobb, who plays angry juror number 3, the one who has the issues about his son.
Yeah.
He was Lieutenant Kinderman in The Exorcist, the detective.
Right, well done. That's
also, though, 12 Angry Men was remade as a TV movie directed by William Friedkin,
Was it called Seven Angry Dwarfs? And was about whether or not Snow White was guilty of murder? Because I would watch that in a heartbeat.
No. Yes, but let's put the idea on the back burner because it's quite good. It was remade for TV, directed by William Friedkin, who directed The Exorcist, and George C. Scott plays Lee J. Cobb's character, which also happened in Exorcist 3 in 1990, where George C. Scott played Lieutenant Kinderman.
Oh, well, well done you. It's very thorough.
There you go.
So, you like The Exorcist, therefore we'll watch 12 Angry Men,
because
it is a tangential connection.
All of my film choices. No, I watched 12 Angry Men for the first time three years ago, I think. And it was one of those films that I've heard about, and you know, you read, you know, lists of the 100 movies you have to see before you die.
I do indeed, because I believe me and Abby watched this the first time, because it was in our book of 501 movies you gotta see or we'll kill you, or whatever it's called.
And, yeah, and it's also, I like films, I can't remember if I've...
You like films? I can't remember, but I like films. What are you saying?
I can't remember if it's come up before, that I particularly like films that are mostly, like...
explaining a lot of old rubbish.
Yeah, exposition and
exposition. The movie is what you want to watch.
Yeah, characters just talking to each other. That is usually my favorite.
Jimmy, are you lonely? You just like people talking.
Yeah, I like the company. It's like when you leave a dog alone in the house and you have to leave the radio on so they don't go mental.
Well, now you don't have to. You got this podcast. It's perfect for when you want to go out of the house and leave your dog with something to listen to. But, hi, Fluffy. You were saying before I derailed you.
Yeah, I saw it because of that. It's been recommended forever as one of the best films ever made, or like top 100, whatever. But also, it's the kind of film I like where it's mostly dialogue driven, and it's almost like and it has been several times, I think, adapted for the stage. Like it could be a play.
Yeah, definitely.
It's, and I thought, well, I should probably watch this because this is the kind of stuff I do really like, and I did. And watching it again now for this has kind of confirmed how much I do actually enjoy it. I really, really like this film. Mm-hmm. And it is exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about when I say I like. Because it's not necessarily exposition. I wouldn't say any of the dialogue between the characters is unnecessary in explaining the story. It's all, you know, necessary. Mm-hmm. But
you're following the piece of string that leads you to the end of the mystery.
My favourite scenes in most of my favourite films, Jaws. Like, my favourite scene in Jaws is...
Is there a shark? Let's find out.
Quint telling the story about him surviving being on the SS Indianapolis.
But did Jaws stab his father? Will we ever know?
What's happening?
I don't know. Well, anyway, thank you, Jamie. Thanks for putting it to us. What were you other guys thinking when Jamie suggested it? Anthony, had you heard of seen of? Had you heard, seen, whatever, the film before?
I've never seen it before, but it's definitely one, like you said, that you've heard of. It's always one of the films that's always heralded as one of the best in cinema history.
My favourite is the sequel, 13 Angry Men.
13 slightly miffed guys.
I said it wrong, you're right. One Happy Guy is so, the first film.
It's just like one of those films like you feel like you have to experience at some point, otherwise you can't really think of yourself as like a cinema person or cinemaphile or whatever. Mm. So, I came into this, I suppose, with a lot of expectation because of that. Like, I knew nothing about it other than like the one-sentence premise. And from that, I suppose you think, oh, well, it's just, it'll have to be a very dramatic and kind of taut film to essentially take an hour and a half in a room with 12 people and make it extremely interesting.
I thought that the first time I watched this film, I thought it was actually going to be a lot bleaker and grittier than it was because it's black and white, called 12 Angry Men. I assumed that there was going to be at least one fight at some point.
Yeah, you're right, actually. I ended up being surprised the first time I watched it that there's never an actual physical confrontation.
No.
But it is interesting that I think the film actually plays with that because there is a scene later on where where Lee J. Cobb, juror number three, is demonstrating the knife, how the murderer supposedly killed his father on Henry Fonda, and they're the two characters. Like, just I don't know. To give an overview, like the idea is that these 12 jurors have been in this trial where an 18-year-old ethnic kid. It's never named what ethnicity he is. So it leaves it open deliberately.
I think it's clearly presumed Latino or something.
Yeah, it's that. That's he looks like he would be maybe Mexican or Latino. Like, I don't know whether I sound racist or not saying this, but he's like generically not white, and because it gives the opportunity then to put all kinds of prejudices on him from these characters. But Henry Fonda is the one dissenting juror at the start, the interesting thing is he's not necessarily defending the kid. He's just saying there is room for reasonable doubt. And then Lee Cobb, juror number three, is the one who's like they all vote guilty, but they're the ones who butt heads is Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb.
And but then, as Abby said, not only figuratively.
Yeah, sorry,
they almost come to blows.
Yeah, they do at one point, but then there's also the really interesting point where you, because it becomes so tense, but there's never any physical violence. When he demonstrates the motion of the knife on Henry Fonda, and he rears back as if he's going to stab him, and they all stand up and panic, and there's this moment of he stops and he says nobody's hurt, and they agree on it, and then he kind of like really gently demonstrates the direction of the knife.
In fairness, there's no way he would have stabbed him in the like a juror stabs another one because they had a disagreement. It wasn't
that's the thing though. It's gotten so tense, and he's clearly going off the rails at that point because he's got more issues than you realize he has at the start. The at least when I watched it for the first time, there was a sense of like, how dark is this going to get? Like, is this suddenly going to turn? Is he actually just going to snap and attack him?
Especially when the thunderstorm starts.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's later on, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's because, like, all the way throughout, they're all so hot and sweaty.
Yeah, yeah.
And claustrophobic. And the whole cinematography just reminds you of kind of old, like, either submarine or war films.
Yeah.
Like, where they're all put in this room and they're, like, worst of enemies and they all have to kind of...
There's a really nice touch in terms of the way it's filmed that I don't know if anybody noticed, but the film starts with lots of wide shots. And then as it goes on, there's more and more close-ups, and it's almost as if the camera moves from above them to eye level until it's finally under them, shooting up at everyone. So it's all these like upshot close-ups to make it really like claustrophobic and intense.
Yeah, I think just purely because of the film it is, because it's set in one room and you only have this one location. Like, as a director or cinematographer, you really have to think on your feet of how to make everything you put on there on screen look interesting.
Yeah,
and they do that really well.
I mean, I don't want to get too heavily into the praise yet, but I think this is one of those films that is if I was a film teacher or whatever, this is one of the ones I would show how to tell a story, because there's nothing happening really in this film. It is just 12 guys in a room, and everything that happens has to happen from character and dialogue. There's no crutch to lean on as a filmmaker. There's nothing cheap you can use to make it interesting. You have to really think about what you're putting in there. And as actors as well, all of them have to make themselves interesting in order to not disappear into the background.
There's a lot of simultaneous acting going on as well. Like, they all are living in the room for the film, but they all move around independently, especially when they come into the room as a jury. They all are just, you know, wandering around, opening windows, turning on fans, trying to look for things. And they all have to do it at the same time, and you have to direct that, and it's really done quite well.
There's so much. There's that slow burn, mounting tension, and if you take, I thought about this when I was watching it yesterday. If you take a screenshot from the beginning and then towards the end, there's the one at the beginning where it's obviously hot in the room, and they're making comments on it, but they all look all right. And then at the end of the film, they've all taken off some layers of clothes. They're all like, they've got sweat under their arms and on their backs and chests. They look rough. And the film happens in real time as well. That's another thing I thought was really interesting. Like, there's no cuts. It all happens over an hour and a half.
It's like, it's hard to imagine now, but this must have been like a highly experimental film for the time.
That's one of the things I thought when the second time I watched it was, yeah, this is for 1957, in terms of not just the story, because the story is quite ahead of its time as well. The idea that they're questioning the jury system and the justice system, and there's all the comments about bleeding hearts and stuff. It's almost very kind of 60s. There's a hint of the 60s kind of hippie, you know, standing up for minorities and stuff like that going on, which, you know, in 1957, especially mainstream American film wasn't necessarily much of a thing. But there's
that's
also
why Henry Fonda's in it. As soon as he's in something, you know you're in for this.
Yeah.
But also, let me tell you the moral tale that'll change your mind and make you check your prejudice at the door.
But there's also... So there's that, I think. It's ahead of its time in terms of story content, but also, yeah, filmmaking technique seems... It seems ahead of its time, but another one of the choices I had that I haven't seen is Alfred Hitchcock's film, one of his early films, Rope, which is another film that I think takes place pretty much in one room, but I don't know if it's in real time. But
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on in films like this at the time that is very different, because it's not a typical story. It's an hour and a half in a room with a bunch of guys who end up disagreeing with each other and fighting, and it evolves in that hour and a half, and it's very natural. Like,
yeah, there isn't one performance in this that I would criticize in terms of skill. There's just one or two things. Like,
you could almost say the only, I would say the only criticism in terms of performance that I would have would be the kind that I don't like, because it's not fair. It's about it being dated. Like, some of the performative techniques they use are a little bit stagey and, you know, 50s.
Yeah, but it's from then. So
yeah, exactly. I think the music was the only other problem I had, because there isn't very much music, which again is pretty different for the time. But when there is music, it's very intrusive and doesn't quite fit. But that's the style of cinema at the time. Like, that's not, I don't consider that a fair criticism.
No.
Yeah, I would have said the same thing. Like, there's noticeably not very much music, but the film does do well in using that silence at times.
Yeah, so, the use of sound is fantastic.
It's all
pretty much diegetic sound. It's all everything that's happening in there.
Mm.
And there's the sounds of the storm later on in the film. There's very little sound from outside, if I remember right. You don't really hear traffic or anything, even though the windows are open, if I remember right.
It's just the room.
There's no colour in it either. It's well boring.
It's black and white.
That's what I thought. I was like, oh, old black and white movie. This will be boring. Oh, it's angry. Ugh.
The only thing, like, for me, it's just taste rather than anything else. Like, the old man who has got, like, the best eyes of the universe,
okay.
He annoyed me a bit, but I think that's just... Well, that's a character that annoys me. It's not...
Old men annoy you.
No, it's just... It's that one moment in particular where he asks a question and then he sort of leans forward in his chair and leans on his hand.
Yeah, I know what you mean. He was a very strange character. He was very... He was almost ethereal. He was like a wizard. Who did?
Well, there was a point where that old guy became like, oh yeah, now that I've changed my mind because of old Henry Fonda here with his, I'm not sure, I don't know. Like, oh, now that you say don't know, let me become Columbo for a minute and go, now, you wearing glasses. I was just wondering, why do you touch your nose like that? Oh, I'm trying to make a point. No. Why do you want to touch your nose? Look, just leave him alone. No, I'm talking to him. Why do you touch your nose? my hurts because of my glasses. Ah, would you say that wearing glasses, you know, it's just like this whole, like, Columbo shtick, and he's so, like...
Well, see, that's, I don't know, because that's so far into the film that I was totally invested at that point.
Yeah.
So I was, you're right.
Just that moment where he leant in, when I very suddenly went, what are you doing?
Oh, you're too close.
That about?
Personal space. it's that does though. That is something that I wanted to specifically talk about. One of the reasons I like this film so much is everything that's in it. Either the people saying that the jurors saying that the kid's guilty or not guilty. Everything we know as the audience comes from the jurors. We don't see any of the evidence.
No.
Well, we do see the knife.
Yeah, and the diagram of the apartment.
We also get the take from the judge that he's a little bit like he's saying the bit like think about the case.
It's going to be
a death penalty if you say guilty. But he seems a bit bored by it, so we could take.
Yeah, I really like that. We don't see the presentations by the lawyers or thing. So everything we hear about the details of the case comes from the jurors. So all of their biases and hypocrisy is there. And I think it's interesting that even towards the end of the film, every time Henry Fonda gets someone else on his side and they all start defending the not guilty decision, you do, from his charisma and his ability to make the argument, you do, you know, you side with him as well because he's the good guy. But then Lee J. Cobb will start like defending the fact that we saw it all happen, and you think, well, what if they did? Like, yeah. What if they are just all falling into this cult of personality? And
could it be happening the other way?
Yeah, it's
and right at the last minute, what should have happened perhaps in the film when they're down to like one guy still thinking he's guilty, it should switch back and be another hour and a half of everyone all the votes going back the other way.
And I mean, I think the idea isn't that Henry Fonda is defending the kid to genuinely say no, I don't think he's guilty. What is really interesting to me is that it's not that simple. He's not defending the kid as not guilty. He's saying that if there's any reasonable doubt, then he shouldn't be executed.
We owe it because it's the death penalty, we have to talk it out.
And make sure we're sure and not just go,
that seems fine.
He has to be guilty beyond any reasonable doubt. And Henry Fonda's not saying the kid didn't do it. He's saying that if there's any reasonable doubt at all, which is what he ends up demonstrating, he shouldn't be executed.
That's what is
interesting to me.
Quick round table, guys. We're going to have a vote system. And I want you to say if you thought the kid was guilty or not. Anthony, guilty, not guilty?
I don't know. That's the whole joy of the... Not joy, beauty of the film is by the end. Like,
just because we decide
it's
the
not
kid
about lived. Whether he's guilty
yeah,
or
not
guilty.
It's not about the kid, it's about the jurors.
But I'm saying, were they right?
I think the evidence sounded a bit circumstantial and that a more thorough investigation should be made.
No, not guilty. Abby's joined in. Not guilty. Jamie, what are you saying? Did the kid stab his dad?
No. Well, I don't know. That's the point. Not guilty because I don't know.
Right. I'm saying he is not guilty. No, yeah, I'm saying he's guilty because there's, like, how else did someone die? There was no sign of any other person having murdered the bloke. So they don't find anyone else. Therefore, the only person it could be is the kid. I'm saying guilty.
But there's reasonable doubt. That's
the point. I am sure of it.
So you're Lee J. Cobb's character.
I'm saying they... Yeah, no, they do. In that case, I think they do have to throw it out because they can't prove it's the kid, but yeah, I think there's no one else it could be, but that doesn't prove it's the kid. Yeah, yeah.
What are you talking about?
I switched. because there was no other suspect, but the kid was the only person who was there. But the thing is, they try and talk about whether it was or not the kid. Yeah, there is just reasonable doubt. I've talked myself, and you've talked me around. Anthony, do you agree? No, like, not there is a doubt, so therefore the kid can go free, or what?
Well, yeah. I mean, the conclusion they come to in the end is probably right.
I love the way that the angriest of the angry men, he kept putting himself in the hole.
Yeah, I know. Once the film starts to really mount with the tension and the anger, and I like that it plants so many seeds at the start that you don't realise. There's that Henry Fonda's character drops in that he's an architect at one point, and it's almost it's a throwaway reference until he asks for the diagram of the apartment. And when he did that, and he was going through like, okay, it's this many feet from here, and then doing the demonstration of the old man who was supposedly a witness limping, I was starting to think, hang on, why is he doing this? And it took me about 2 or 3 minutes to remember, oh yeah, he's an architect. Like, he would know exactly what that distance is and how that would work.
Well, he also, like, every character's like that, not, you know, an architect, but they each have their own take on the world. They establish their old men or their foreigners or their builders or their salesmen, and they all have, like, you know, motivation, whether they're racist or want to go to a baseball game. But each of their own personal things in their own world add something to unravelling something else about the case, whether it's the fact that they wear glasses or that they have a personality that feels a certain way. They can understand a different perspective, and it adds to the case and the explaining why things may or may not have happened how they were said to have done.
that was another sort of that one of the best things that adds depth to the film is that every conclusion that's reached comes from something about the jurors and nothing really to do with the case. It comes from personal experience, prejudice, not what's, I don't know what the opposite with prejudice be, but like Henry Fonda trying to defend, you know, the underdog or whatever.
It comes from everything. Empathy, it all comes from them. Plays into it.
Yeah. And it's just this, there's so many layers to it. I was going to say something. Oh, the guy who works in advertising.
He's such an annoying idiot at the start as well. He's like, I was just, I thought it'd be funny to tell an anecdote about me in my office. And it's like, they all, like every joke he tells, it just dies at its ass. And then I think accidentally he says something like about licking milk up. And everyone's like, ah, that's a really weird thing to say. Oh,
yeah,
funny.
He does what he makes a joke about earlier, because he jokes about how guys in advertising always do this thing when there's a meeting where they stand up and say, oh, let's run this up the flagpole and see who salutes it. And he laughs about it. But then as the film goes on and it gets more tense, he starts doing it because he's in a situation where that's what he knows. And the other one is the... it's Lee J. Cobb's character. Right at the start of the film, he starts talking about kids and how he hasn't seen his son for 2 years and respect. And, you know, when I was a kid, I called my dad sir. So you've got this idea that he has issues with being a father, and he has issues, you know, he's obviously very insecure. Mm. But I really like that it never goes beyond just that vague idea that he hasn't seen his son in 2 years. But from that, all of his behavior makes sense, and you can read so much into it without the film telling you anything.
I think also, because it's obviously saying his own father-son issues are playing into the case, but he's also in a position where he's been very vehemently, is that the right word?
Vehemently, yeah.
Yeah, he's vehement. Oh, I can't say it. He's very confident in his opinion that they're guilty. Yeah. And then to have people slowly change their minds, it kind of undermines. It's like, well, I can't back out of this now. So I think some of it isn't just that reason, but it's his own personal...
No, it's his own...
I can't change my mind now. I'm stubbornly sticking to it as
well. Yeah, he seems like someone who people don't disagree with him very often, and he doesn't know how to cope with it. Yeah. But... also, what I liked again about that character is that he wasn't the racist, because that would be a really cliche thing to do, is to also make him really racist. But there was another character who was racist as fuck, and
not immediately. He sort of snuck up on you a bit when you're like, oh, that's not.
Yeah, he started dropping it in there.
That kind of casual old people thing.
Yeah, but then there's that fantastic scene where he just goes off.
Hang on. When I'm not going to let you get away with fantastic scene. And he goes off on one, and he starts being really racist and saying, you all know what I mean, they're all like that, that race of people. But it's not fantastic, Jimmy, because they all get up and give him the silent treatment. They all, one by one, I'm turning my back. It's such a theatrical, no one would just get up and turn their back on him.
No, they're ignoring him. They're letting him... Like, they're trying to pretend that he's not saying it, because they're like, oh, this is way beyond anything any of us have said.
Oh, like, it was all a bit like Dead Poets Society, where they all stand up on the desk and shout.
That's one of the best scenes of the film, where they all turn their backs on him.
It's not. It's a really weird moment where they all stand in awkwardly different ways. I get it, but I found it a bit weird that they all... turned their backs as if to say, we don't agree with you, sir. You have crossed a line.
Have you never been in a situation like that? Don't you remember in school where, like, something happen when I was in, I think I was about 15. There was a kid, he was a fucking idiot. And he never did any work to bring in, to, like, hand in to the teacher. And she was this old, like, angry old battle axe of a woman. And one day she just had enough. So he had lied to her and said that he'd submitted it. So she got him to stand up in the middle of the class and grilled him on it. Where is it? where did you put it? And he kept lying. Like, he was adamant that he'd put it under the door of her office. And she was saying, so if I go up there now and I open my office door, it'll be on the floor. And he was saying, yes, yes, it will. He just kept, and by the, it kept going. And that's what happened. No one in the classroom was looking at him or her because they couldn't.
Unanimously back turned on him.
Yeah, everyone was just looking at their desks and thinking, oh, God, stop, stop.
But they end up making a point of it. Like, one or two of them are going, oh, mate, you've gone too far. But some of them are like, I shall get up and I will not listen. It's a bit too formal for me.
No, there are people like that.
But 12? Are there 11 of them, Jamie? 11 people who will not let racism go too far?
I thought that was a great scene. And it was great that it singled him out like that, to the point where he got up and went to sit at the naughty desk and didn't say another word.
I didn't know where he was going for a minute.
He's going to walk out the window and fall down.
Yeah.
I like we don't know why he changed his mind, because he changes his mind at a point where some valid, reasonable doubt things come up, but we don't know if it's that or because he's defeated.
I think it's because everyone ignored him, he kind of had to turn the focus on himself and realize what he was doing. He was using prejudice to judge.
The more he talked himself into a hole, I think the more he started to realize, I'm
a pleb.
I see what I'm doing, kind of thing, yeah.
And it was like,
damn those ethnics, they've made me this way!
And he went and sat in that chair, and he looked so defeated, like on a deep personal level. Because his realization of, oh, I only think he's guilty because he's, you know, he's brown. Like, that was it.
Fair enough.
Plus, that scene comes in a moment. Like, it's like three quarters of the way through, and like, I suppose as audience members, you know, we've gone through this as well. We're all kind of getting tired and our tensions are up.
Pit stink as well.
So it just comes at a moment where of relief for the audience as well, clarity as well.
So, yeah, and it's also nice you know what I mean? It's a relief that of all of them and all their reasons for voting guilty initially, he's the only one who's basing it on pure prejudice.
Well, I think the sales guy has some of that shtick as well. Like, but the sales character guy who I believe was in our last film. He played the president in.
Yes, you're right, President Bobby. Jack Ward.
Well, he was like the white guy who wore a hat and wanted to get out there for the baseball. He had lots of reasons that seemed like he might be a bit racist or generalizing, but his main problem was that he didn't care generally.
Yeah, his reason for not guilty was, I think, he was just an entirely selfish character. He didn't really want to be there. He didn't care. He wanted to get it over with quickly so he could go to the ball game.
Yeah, and
do that gesture he was doing. I
have no idea what that means.
Neither did anyone else. That was the great thing. The guy just stared at him when he did it.
There was the other time that when the coach was talking about, like, he was talking about a football game because he's a coach, and he did a weird gesture as well. I'm like, you all have to stop doing this. I have no idea.
That's how I always feel when anyone talks about sports, to be fair.
I think that's less the characters in the film and more just us. As people.
Unless they're doing the gesture for get the ball through the basketball hoop. We're out. We're done.
Well, there was some nice pseudo-basketball stuff where he starts throwing balled up pieces of paper at the fan. And one of them hits the old guy you don't like, Happy.
Don't like is a strong word.
Do you know what the thing that made me laugh about the balled up paper hitting the old man in the head wasn't that what happened on camera. It was the idea that when they filmed it, he would have to sit there and someone would have to be just off camera screwing up a piece of paper and then just chucking it at the side of his head.
Those are some of my favourite moments in films when I have that weird thing where I go, I know how you did that. And that was hilarious.
And how funny it would have been for all of you.
Well, okay. I'm being devil's advocate a bit. I'm being, you know, the last vote and the opposite opinion a bit. I'm trying to find things. But there is another thing I think is a valid area where you go, oh, come on, you're stretching credibility here. And when it's when Henry Fonda has been like just going, oh, just reasonable doubt, I just want to have a talk about it, it's fine. And after a while, he's usually crusading for a not guilty vote, because that's his opinion, essentially. And it's the point where he goes, we need the knife in here, can we get the knife? And then it comes in eventually, and they're arguing. And he's like, well, that's a pretty unique knife, isn't it? Well, I have bought the exact same one from the same street the murder was committed in, and I will stab it into the table symbolically and go, nah, I bought the murder weapon myself.
I agree with you that as a moment in itself, in reality, that would be very strange. But when it happens, the moment it actually happens in the film, it's like, I don't know, it's such a powerful moment.
Well, I think the mistake here is that Rich is thinking this film is realistic because it's...
Well, has anyone done jury duty?
No.
But I'm pretty sure it wouldn't all be middle-aged white men.
Yeah. maybe it probably would have been in the 50s.
Before we get too far away...
Even then, like...
Abby.
I just want to point out how annoyed I was that they kept stabbing the table. Like, yeah. That's not your property. That is the city property. You're stabbing up.
Also, Henry Fonda admitted to getting the knife illegally, and therefore we should see the trial of Henry Fonda for buying a weapon without the appropriate license or whatever you need.
But, no, I think it's a mistake to assume that this film's going to be realistic just because it's set with 12 guys in a room.
Well, sit there sweating and arguing. Well, I was going to say,
Well, yeah, but if it was played realistically, it would be as boring as the synopsis actually sounds.
Can I just say, the whole film put me in mind of various library meetings. I work in a library occasionally, and I have had, like, it's a county library, and it's like a village library, and it's a lot of volunteers, and it's a lot of village people coming together and trying to decide how to run a library. And I've been there, and it's lasted an hour and a half, and it's just been deciding whether we need to get rid of some books or get some new shelves. And we are all sweating. Lots of people are angry with each other, yelling, getting in each other's faces. Some people are like playing games, waiting for it to end.
Yeah, more than once, you have come back from those meetings looking worse than the men did at the end.
They are heated and weird debates. And they usually end in someone who actually works in the library going, yeah, we're not doing any of that. We're doing whatever we want. Goodbye. Your opinions weren't valid. You've sweated for nothing.
Nothing is going to change. Thanks for your time.
Yeah.
But I think the strength of this film, or the power in this film, is that if it strikes a chord with you and you get into it when you're watching it, it viscerally feels very real and relatable. Whereas if you step outside it and look at it logically, like Rich is trying to do now, a lot of it doesn't make sense, and you know, it wouldn't play out like that in real life. But that isn't where the power of the film is. Like that's the same as people watching The Dark Knight and going, it's not really realistic, though, is it? Like, of course it's bloody not. If somebody dressed like a bat to fight crime, they would be in prison.
I think they've come up... I do like the film. I don't think it's particularly unrealistic either. I thought that was just a few... There's a few areas where you go, oh, come on. Like,
well, it's substituting powerful storytelling for realism, and that's fine. As long as it makes sense in the film. Don't you remember when you did your, pretentious film course in university, like we all did, the word verisimilitude?
No, I didn't do film. I studied proper stuff, like visual communication.
We never used that term in ours, because was far more...
You're saying something about mise-en-scène, or what's your pretentious point, Jimmy?
Verisimilitude means that something, like, it can be as unrealistic in terms of real life as it wants to be, as long as it makes sense within its own universe. Like, the reason that some, like, over-the-top films are still good is because they don't contradict themselves. Whereas others... Yeah, exactly. Die Hard makes perfect sense. It follows its own logic, but it follows it. Whereas Die Hard 4 has a bunch of scenes that don't even make sense within itself.
Well, I if you're going to argue that you can't take down a helicopter with a cop car, I submit Exhibit A, Bruce Willis takes down a helicopter in a cop car. I brought it up because I thought it was like, Anthony, you agree with me, right? It was a little bit, oh, come on, like.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing does feel like it was inspired by like a stage play. So because of that,
it was a TV like a teleplay, which was a thing in like the 50s, and then I think it was adapted for stage first a couple of times, and then Henry Fonda I think fought for it to be adapted to the big screen, and there's a couple of cast members in it from the teleplay as well. I think the advertising guy and the old man Jack Sweeney were in the original version.
Okay, well, what my point was is just because it is just people in a room, some things will at some point feel stagey. But yeah, that knife moment.
Yeah.
Like you really needed something at that moment to break things up.
You have to have something big. It's like the guy going on the racist rant and everybody turning their backs on him. You have to have something that is visually engaging at the sacrifice of being realistic. Because in real life, if somebody went on a racist rant like that and people were against him, everyone would just start going, shut up. Shut the fuck up. What are you talking about?
That's what I mean. All right, Jay, you're right. Not guilty. The film's great. Give in.
It would be interesting, actually, to do a really realistic remake of this with a bunch of, like, British, maybe even Welsh people around the table.
I tell you how it goes. 11 people say not guilty. One says, 11 people say guilty. One person says not guilty. And they go, oh, fucking hell, man. And he goes, all right. And they go to prison and not jail to be executed. They go to prison, but they don't get executed because no capital punishment in your face. That's how it happened. I get what you're saying. Like, fair enough. I think we should talk about some of the other littler characters as well a bit, because there's a few that are in the background for quite a while. Like, the film goes, it spends a while going round the table hearing people out, other people interrupt, get all het up and talk, and we eventually get a little word from everyone. And I think some of the interesting characters are, like, there's a mustachioed foreign guy who has been taking notes and quietly has a point at the end. There's quite a small, specky guy who's, everyone just seems to bully all the time. Just seems to dismiss him as, like, just a pencil-necked geek.
It's Piglet from Winnie the Pooh.
Is that who that is?
Oh, yeah. My God, yes.
Yeah. It's quite a weird... It would be quite good to make this with some of the people playing their other characters. Abby, have you got anyone? You know, you're a champion of the underdog sometimes. Any little people who stood out to you?
I don't understand what you mean.
Like, any other of the characters, like, I don't know, the working lackey man who, I just do what the boss says, you know. Anyone you picked out from there? Yeah.
Not so much, because they're fairly even as a group, and a lot of them have got some fair chops as actors. I spent most of my time just going, you're all doing a really good job.
I really liked E.G. Marshall, the guy who... I think he's the last guy before Lee J. Cobb to finally say not guilty. The one who never sweats.
The one
who has the conversation about eyeglasses. He's great. I loved how just stern he was the whole time. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that he was the one who told the old racist to sit down and not say another word.
It was a weird moment as well, with the bit about the glasses that finally sort of turned him around. I sympathise with that in particular, because if you're a person who always wears glasses, someone goes, oh, she wasn't wearing glasses, like, yeah, you're right.
Yep.
She didn't see anything through an L train with those eyes.
And again, another bit of, something that wasn't particularly realistic but is very effective in the film is that earlier, because it's so hot, someone says to him, don't you ever sweat? And he says, no.
Yeah.
And then when he finally turns, he's got that single drop of sweat on the side of his forehead.
Yeah, do you remember what film you saw? The kid says he didn't remember. Do you remember? I remember vaguely. I mean,
yeah.
There was this this one guy. Basically, he made his own little film podcast there, and I was like, oh, that film sounds quite interesting. Could do with a few more details, but I guess that'll do.
Also, Piglet threw him under the bus.
Oh.
It's like, I saw that movie. It was called something else. Shut up.
Yeah, you guys can shut up when I say stuff wrong.
Yeah, I was just talking about this guy. From the look of him, he's got that kind of slick, kind of sharp like look to him where, I don't know about you guys, but coming in, you think like, oh, this is going to be about a jury. So the obvious kind of plot thing to happen is that one of them is like on
the murderer.
Something. Yeah, well, essentially trying to be like trying to convince them all of the wrong thing. Yeah. And like, if you, from the beginning, if you line them all up, you go that guy.
Yeah.
But like, it's totally like the whole film is not about any of that. It's not about like kind of intrigue.
Yeah. There's no twist or anything.
It's all
like
just
that.
About the personal person that they are.
Abby, were you going to say you thought Henry Fonda's character did it or what?
I think Henry Fonda actually killed that man, and he didn't want the other guy to go to jail.
Yeah, I half expected. Do you know they like Henry Fonda helps the last guy to change his mind, helps his court on and gets him out, and then he's left in the room on his own. I half expected him to try and kill someone, like just stab them in the chest downwardly with the knife he brought in.
I know,
and then wink to camera.
The first time you watched it, I was expecting it to turn out that he was in some way involved in the kid's life. So,
yeah, you just,
and I was,
he puts his arm around the kid when they leave and stuff.
But I was really glad that that didn't happen. And it ended with me going, no, it was actually just about those characters.
It's weird, actually, because like, at the very, very end, when they're coming out, they've made the decision, they all leave, they're all tired. But we see Henry Fonda and the old guy, the older-ish small guy coming out.
Yeah.
And he goes up to him, oh, hey, what's your name there, guy? And you're like, what is he? Is he Jesus? Is he a BG? What's the thing? Like, my name is Lopez. Lopez Foreign Man. And, you know, like, whatever it's going to be. And then the guy's like, Davis. Oh, my name's whatever. Yeah.
Bye.
And it's just like, I guess we have no reason to keep talking. But like, that's such a weird ending.
Because you almost think, oh, they're going to be friends now. But no, they all just go their separate ways.
My name is Turncoat Liar McKill.
Again, another really nice piece of camera work that's quite subtle, like you feel it rather than see it, is that the shot of them leaving at the end of the film is that huge open shot of the staircase. And it feels so freeing after being in that room for an hour and a half with everyone.
Hmm. Yeah, because you know when you've got 12 people defined by their characters, you know, defined by something that they say or do, and you know it's been claustrophobic. You probably are sweating because it's quite tense. It's a genuine relief. A, when it starts raining, and B, when they leave at the end and they've come to their conclusion, and you just go, ah. Oh. And now I don't have to see angry, sweaty, like oldie, like all of the names you could come up with them. Like this, you just kind of need to remember them by, oh, you're the guy who everyone thought changed his mind first, but wasn't. You're the guy who just sat there quietly, you know.
It's a great shot, I think, at the end, because like I said, you feel it. When I watched it, I got that idea of, you know, the smell of concrete when it's been hot for ages and then rains?
Yeah,
that's what I thought of. Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
That's what would happen if it was a scratch and sniff film. It would scratch and sniff and it'd be that smell. You'd also have just a lot of male BO for the start of it.
Yeah, that room must have stunk.
I don't know if anyone, like, picked up on it or whether there was actual, like, point to it, but I felt like there was something more symbolic about the taking off of jackets than I could pick up on. Just like, do any of you reckon like there's some sort of symbolism to it? Like they're all taking them off at a certain point when something happens?
I think it could be.
I did kind of lose track after a while, but I don't know if anyone kind of got that.
The idea that the facade is being like stripped away, and as they gradually like start to think about why they're saying guilty and change their minds, they start to take off layers of clothes. So I'm turning it, the way I'm describing it, into some sort of weird porn version of 12 horny men.
No, it's like, you know, it's showing how it becomes, it's visually showing they're getting worn out and they have to dig in and roll up their sleeves and get to it. They can't just casually vote like they wanted to.
But it wasn't so overt as, like, all the good guys are wearing white jackets and all the bad guys are wearing black kind of thing.
The only one wearing white is Henry Fonda.
It only occurred to me towards the end, the whole time, he's been completely wearing white, Maverick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it also unifies them all, because like a few of them stand out a bit more visually, like especially like the sales guy's got his hat and his weird jacket, and then when they're all in their shirts and ties, they all start to look more like, you know, the same person.
Yeah.
I also, like, the one person that I think we haven't mentioned much, which I think is a really interesting role, and I want you guys to think about while I'm saying this, who you think you empathised more, who would you be in the room? And I'm going to say I would have been the guy who sort of tried to do the admin of it. He was like, oh, we should all sit like this. Just suggesting things calmly, like, oh, maybe if you don't want to do it, it's fine, but I think we should all sit in our numbers. And he was the guy getting all of the things from the, all the evidence. He would ask for it and he'd put it back. And he kind of kept order in the room and tried to mediate, even though he lost his rag a few times because people would challenge him. And, you know, he just tried his best to chair the meeting, didn't he? And I really liked that guy.
I liked his the first time his power is questioned, he sulks and someone asks something, he says,
no,
okay.
I'm not doing it. Whatever. I tried reasonable, and no one else wanted to hand out the bits of paper and you question me when I'm trying to be reasonable. That's how I feel all the time. I'm just being reasonable. And you're fine, you don't want to go along with it, you know. So that's I felt I the most empathy with him. I felt like that would be me. I would try and be sensible and organised, but fundamentally useless. begrudgingly carrying on with being in charge. Did you guys pick anyone else out who you thought I'd be the massive racist or the pencil necked guy or Abby, who do you think you would have been? Let's start with you.
Oh, Henry Fonda.
You'd have been like, wait a minute, you'd be the wise sage going.
Not that so much. I'd be the one I'd actually be a slightly different person again, where I'm sitting in the trial going, oh, this evidence is bogus. You don't know what you're doing.
If anything, I watched it and went, actually, come on, should we, perhaps now that we've got all these questions, shouldn't the jury get to ask some questions and go, hang on, we've talked for a bit. There's loads of stuff we need to check. Madam, do you wear glasses? Yeah, no, you know, there's loads of questions. If we just find out. If the old man, can we see the old man walk across the room as fast as he can? Can we see, like, that? Surely you should just get everyone back into court and do it again. That would be the fair thing.
I don't think the jury's allowed to ask questions like that, like direct questions.
The system is.
They're allowed to ask questions during the trial.
Oh, okay.
I think they have some kind of power like that.
Yeah.
Because I've definitely heard things of, like, the jury had to go and see this thing happen and blah 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 blah.
Okay, right.
So I don't know if I think they have some powers like that, and they
see,
do kind of bringing in like the evidence, like they kind of use it where they can, I suppose.
Yeah. Can we see L Trade go past, please, and time it? Because like, we think it's 10 seconds, but we're all guessing. Like okay, Anthony, who did you think, that's me, I'd be that person?
I'd be the same as Abby. I'd think I'd be like the Henry Fonda character. Yeah. Because I'm a bit of a contrarian sometimes.
Yeah, so
if everyone voted guilty, I'd be like, well.
What if it was the other way? What if everyone was like, no, I don't think there was a case. Wait a minute, guys.
If it was the other way, I think I would be that guy, unfortunately.
Wait a minute, I don't want this kid coming out and stabbing me.
Just because I don't want things to be that simple. It's like, it can't be that simple, guys. Let's just think about this. I think I'd be that guy.
You're very moral contrarians, both of you. Jamie, who would you be?
I would be juror number 6. I'm not much one for supposing. I let my boss go. I'm just a simple working man.
So,
I related with him the most, probably, because I was like, yeah, so I keep my head down and just not make a fuss if I don't have to.
Oh, it's great not to be at work, isn't it, guys?
Yeah. I'm just enjoying a day off.
Oh, look at this. I'm in a bathroom. That's fun. Hey, Henry Fonda, how's it going? You should agree with me, but this bathroom swell.
Swell.
is that what you're going for? You truly think you're that guy?
Probably, yeah.
I don't know. I had you down as moustached Forno, chip up with a few notes midway.
It was so right, sweet actually, when he stood up and read out what he thought.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, you're right. Now that you've said notes, that probably would be me. I'd probably be sitting there making a bunch of notes, and I wouldn't say anything for ages until I knew I'd picked the right side, and then I'd stand up and read my notes. Yeah.
I think also the guy would, like, I've been in other types of meetings where if I didn't care more, I think I'd have been the guy who really said very little and got a bit annoyed when everyone assumed he changed his mind and had a, like, people assume, like, he got shouted at by angry dad.
Oh, Quincy.
Oh, the guy from the slum, Quincy. Yeah.
He just sat there going, I don't want to say anything. Like, I think,
like, oh, you, like, would change your mind. You're like, what?
I've been in job centre meetings where I've just been, I abstain from speaking.
Whatever
is fine. Life.
Yeah. This is all, we're not getting it. Everyone's going to get shouting. I don't, just carry on. And, you know, whatever's fine. And then, you know, he has his moments, but I think I empathise with him as well.
I was going to say, and because of that, because of his kind of attitude all the way throughout, like, when he steps up and gives the whole speech about the flick knife, it's like, yeah, I totally believe you. Like, you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I empathise with him because I'm from the mean streets of Llanelli. And I know how to flick a flick knife out and how to stab someone in the chest, okay? And I'd be there like, no. If you want to stab someone, you do a little Zorro, a little bit of flares.
In this particular instance, I never thought I would ever make this comparison between you two, but Anthony is from these slightly meaner streets than you.
Yep.
I'm not originally from the mean streets. I'm from, like, just towny, from town. Like,
yeah, I grew up in all that rubbish.
Yeah.
Just like that guy.
Yeah. He was quite relatable, actually, when he said, you know, I grew up with garbage in the back. I'm like, yes, like.
You were called the Moseys.
The hard life in Southwest Wales.
Anyway, so we all are kind of saying we wouldn't have been the horrible guys, vehemently guilty, and we're not backing out of it.
There's an argument we made that I was Piglet.
But... Do you want to make a case, Abby?
It's more just the sort of niceness of him. So I go, am I going, anyone want a sweet?
Come on, Pooh Bear. You've heard the arguments. Christopher Robin didn't do it. I don't care what he says. That honey-eating bastard's a guilty son of a bitch. Who are you going to believe, Rabbit? I trust Rabbit sooner than I trust anyone else.
Apart from the racist guy, nobody's, like, horrible. Because Lee J. Cobb has... Like, he comes across as angry and almost the villain, but when his, and I wanted to mention this as well before it gets wrapped up, and his final speech where he finally says not guilty was fantastic. Mm. I really, really liked the way he just breaks down.
Mm. I wasn't sure about him, like, it took him ripping up his picture of his son to go, oh, I see.
Because he realised what he was... That's why he ripped it up. He looked at it and he thought, I'm just thinking about this in terms of me and my own son. And it made him so angry to be angry himself.
I guess.
And he just lost it.
I think what's good about him as a character... I mean, him and, like you said, the guy next to him, who was, like, the non-sweating, reasonable... Yeah. He was a very reasonable man when we heard the evidence. And there's plenty of reasons why... you guys aren't necessarily correct when you come up with plot holes or loopholes in why the kid couldn't have done it and why the witnesses aren't credible. But I thought, like, his last rant at the end was like, yeah, I guess the thing is, lots of people have took turns slightly making up fairy stories as to what could have happened, and the evidence was witnesses said they heard or saw things. So he's kind of legitimate. He's not wrong. Yeah. He's just... You know, there's doubt, but he's like, well, the witnesses said they saw it. Who am I to say?
Yeah,
it's
not necessarily that he's wrong, and it's more that he refuses to think of it in any more depth than how it was presented.
Yeah, he's
and again,
stubborn,
I think that's and that's his character, that he saw what he considers to be the facts, and now he doesn't want them to be questioned. And like I said about the not having seen his son for 2 years, it comes into what you can read into the very little information you have. That kind of attitude is probably what's led to him and his son becoming alienated from each other, because he's so stubborn and unshakable that it drives people away. And it drove the whole jury away, and he was the last one. And that's why he has, because it's happening again, it's happening again. And then he sees the picture of his son and tears it up because he sees, you know, his entire life in that little room, and then he breaks down because that's the realization of, you know, things beyond what's happening. with those 11 other guys.
Is it Jamie, or are we projecting what we think onto him? Yeah.
Yeah. See,
you're
exactly.
making up a little story to justify it, but all we saw was 12 men talk to each other in a room. Were any of them the characters we make them out to be?
See, you're being facetious, but the film does actually do that on purpose.
Yeah.
I'm not being facetious. I'm being very clever. I'm undercutting it with wit. I have learned from the film and then are using the film's own rules against it. For I have truly learned how to be a decent judging person.
The apprentice is now the master.
And I will be doing a film where I moralise, pretending to be Henry Fonda next
One
week.
Angry man. It's just you in a room having an argument with yourself for an hour and a half.
Sometimes I wonder if this is what this is and I'm just imagining you guys.
Just hallucinating an entire series of podcasts.
Or are you imagining me? What's sadder, really? Anyway, before we get pointlessly meta, we're coming to a point where we're getting to that sweaty armpit stage of the podcast where we want to come to a conclusion and hash out what are we going with? Is the film good or is it terrible? Which is it, you know?
Good grief.
What?
Sorry, some kind of shadow just passed over me. I'm assuming there's a moth or something that managed to completely blot out my light.
It's that Latino kid. He strikes again.
Yeah.
I'm already projecting. We don't know who's Latino. He could have been Indian or Pakistani or Mexican, but just not white, damn it. Not all bred.
Generic all bred. Johnny Foreigner. That's...
Yeah. Jonathan Foreigner. Okay, so let's go around the table and get a result for how the film fared. I think we all think it's guilty of being great, right, guys? But let's
We're not doing the metaphor this week.
Oh, I guess we will.
I don't know why I said that. I haven't got one.
No, me.
Yeah, you really dropped us all in it then, because I haven't thought
of this. This is metaphorically our summing up. So we can literally do the scene from the film. We go around the table, and we all get annoyed when we get to me, and I'm like, hang on, guys, this film's not any good. Let me talk
you
around.
For, yeah. Say, yeah, it is.
So that's what we're about to do. Abby.
Hang on, is it not guilty of being bad or guilty of being good?
You can phrase it however you want. Abby will set the precedent.
Okay.
Yeah, fuck you. This film is guilty of being good.
Right.
It is very good, and I thought of a shit metaphor if you want it.
Go on, yeah.
This film is like a Kinder Egg. But it's Kinder
Egg. I swear Kinder Egg is more often than not something we go to on spoiler film than a metaphor.
But this time it's a Kinder Egg where someone has told you that there isn't a prize inside.
Right.
But you have reasonable doubt. It's like, no, there's a prize in there. There's no prize.
But we don't get to see what's in there.
Yeah.
We just get the accounts of people who've made the egg. I put the wrapper on and I know there was nothing to wrap it around. Well, I'm the old man who made the chocolate and I'm telling you, I heard there was no toy in there when it was rattling.
That might be the weirdest metaphor any of us has ever used.
I said it was bad.
You said it was shit, Abby. Exhibit A. Rewind the tape. She said shit. No, so you're saying it's like a Kinder Egg mystery. What? I don't understand, really. I've tried my best. But you're saying it's good. That's the main thing,
I am,
right?
Saying it's good.
Good film. Anthony?
Yeah, guilty. It's pretty damn good, isn't it? Yeah, it kind of lives up to its reputation, at least in my eyes anyway. It's just so engaging. It's like you don't expect it to be so engaging. And then, you know, it's such a good little story because it's about each of the individual characters, but then it's also about the broader kind of meaning about, you know, judging people and human nature and perception. And
everyone who's going to be a juror should watch this film before they're a juror, so that they do a good
actually,
job.
Yeah. And it's just the performances are great, the cinematography is great, even though it's just black and white, although you could argue that black and white looks a lot better on film.
I think this film suits black and white as well,
yeah.
Because there's so many people in it, have so many clothes, and then there's the room itself. It could be quite easy to be distracted from what's happening by
Henry Fonda's ruby slippers or something.
I agree. And it was probably done that way just because it's a kind of cheap film, but then because it's in black and white, it kind of always makes you think about, you know, this isn't black and white, if you know what I mean. It's all a grey area.
Mm. Oh, it was like that when they said the man in the grey flannel suit. I was like, oh, he's actually wearing grey. That isn't just because it's black and white. Yeah. That man is actually wearing grey.
They're all wearing grey suits, yeah. yeah, just brilliantly directed, brilliantly shot, written, performed. Like you said, there's not much music, and when it does happen, it's not really needed because they use like silence and sound very well. Yeah, like a little stagey because it's a little play-y, but no, it's really good. It's really worth its reputation, I think.
It's very a little pure play-y kind
of filmmaking. Play-y.
Play-y. I'm going to see a play-y. Sorry.
That's all right. I do not have a metaphor. I'm so sorry.
I think you got there with the black and white colour thing. It was like,
yeah, that was better than any of us are going to come up with now.
I'll take it. Yeah.
You take that, and I can explain my one better at the end.
I will justify my Kinder Egg metaphor every time.
Jimmy.
Yeah, excuse me, I am the self-appointed guy in charge. Yeah. Juror number three, please. if everyone could just shut up, mutiny. And we let the guy go at the right time, yeah? Jimmy, juror number three.
Yeah, guilty of being fucking brilliant. Having seen it a second time now, it's probably one that I'm going to seek. I know there's a Criterion Collection Blu-ray of it, so I will probably be buying that. This has crept up into my favorite films list, I think. There's so much to it, and I think it's one of those films that is definitely a, you know, repeated viewings film, and one that you watch it again and again. And then
why would you need
to?
Surely, you know, it's the same case every time. It's not like they do. It's not like a TV series where each week the same jury decides what's happening in the case.
No, you know, like this.
How could you watch the same?
I don't think you understand really liking a film.
I understand. I like the film, also, and like, let's see the case solved again.
No, because there's layers to it. That's what I mean. Every time you watch it, you can think about something else that's going on beneath the basic surface of the film. And that's the kind of thing I like. I like to be given the opportunity to analyze a film by the people who made it.
Sure.
But also I don't think there's any pretension to it. It's none of it is done for the sake of being, you know,
it's not being preachy. It's just questioning,
art house. It's not trying to be layered. It just is because it's so well written and well made.
It's making a point about democracy and prejudice and the jury system, you know.
Yeah,
it never fully celebrates or denounces like the whole system.
Yeah,
of,
and
like,
it doesn't even come to a conclusion in terms of whether or not the kid was actually guilty or not guilty. It's all about the people and their opinions, and I just think it's fantastic. I don't have a metaphor though. I'm gonna have to just back Anthony's up. The whole like black and white grey area, that was really good.
We say it's black and white, but truly there are plenty of grey areas. That's fair enough. So, myself, what's my vote? I'm going to say it is not guilty of being a good film, because if you want a bunch of angry men in one room wearing suits, shirts and ties, and getting annoyed, and they all have weird character traits, you want to check out Reservoir Dogs, and you want to see you want to see Mr. Blonde, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink, and Eddie, and all of them have a big angry standoff in a room, and it's got colour, so you can see all the gory blood, and people do hurt each other. It's all very exciting. The dialogue is much more interesting and funny. They talk about Madonna and whether or not the song is songs are... I'm being facetious. The film is also...
But you're also right, because Reservoir Dogs is another really good film in the same vein as this. Yeah. Like
and clearly has taken inspiration from this film.
It's obviously a
huge...
Well,
no one's ever accused Tarantino of taking inspiration from anywhere. but like obviously it is correctly in the book of 501 movies you should probably check out or you'll die of cancer or no. It's like a really good, it's a really good film, and it really challenges you to think about, you know, your own opinions and what, why you come to conclusions, and just how annoyingly awkward it is for have strangers. Like, it's, there's never a fair way to decide if someone's guilty or not when, you know, when can you be certain of anything? And it's like, it's a really good film to make you question a lot of stuff. And like you say, every single person, all 12 of the several non-dwarfs, and they're all their characters, they're all really interesting, the actors do a great job. I endorse it. It's a unanimous guilty of being a great movie. Ah, 12, four happy people all in one podcast, guys. Now let's go outside and not go to the baseball.
Okay. Yeah.
Except, can I explain?
Oh, yeah, sure, Abby. The last...
I didn't explain it properly.
You have your Henry Fonda looking back at the camera moment and explaining.
It, the reason it is like a Kinder Egg that someone has told you there isn't a prize inside is because the blurb makes the film sound really, really boring, and it's not.
There you go.
There you go.
Wait, I still don't understand. What do you mean?
It's a Kinder Egg, surprise and all, but the blurb would lead you to believe that this film isn't good and that there isn't a prize inside the egg.
Also, the premise of... 12 people discuss a court case at length in a room while they sweat.
Yeah. No, you're right. That sounds boring as shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, we bust open that, you know, Kinder Surprise, and we got to the toy inside, and, you know, all of us were entertained, and then, you know, happy enough. Chewed on some chocolate. I'm still not sure I understand this metaphor.
No,
it's,
I don't.
To extend
your metaphor, is the toy inside one of the ones that comes complete, or one you have to put together?
Ooh. I think it's got to be a build-it-your-own one, right? Because
One of the good ones that actually fits together properly.
It's a mole with a little gavel.
Oh, Abby, that's we all thought put it together, and you're like, it's a mole with a gavel. And that is not a put it together. We're going to have to, right, everyone sit down. We're all deciding which Kinder Surprise toy is correct for the metaphor. I could do this joke all day. Like, seriously, there's not any part of this film that I can't recreate in the podcast. Just want every bit to happen in a new meta way. Oh, anyway, we shouldn't do that. Let's actually finish, right, guys?
Yeah.
Indeed.
Please say yes.
Yes.
I want to go outside and live in the real world again.
Please, fuck off.
Goodbye, listener. Join us again while we all sit round a metaphorical table have it out.
Stop.
Shut up, I'm saying goodbye, you tossbag. Fuck's sake.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.